Welcome to More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it. Today we are recording from Astoria, Queens, Rock Springs, Arizona, and Saratoga, California. Our guest today is Ravi Murthy. He is the Senior Director of Engineering at Google. Ravi, talk to us a little bit.
Hey, JD. Great to be on the show. My name is Ravi Murthy, and I lead a bunch of engineering teams in Google Cloud Databases, and excited to be part of the conversation here.
All right. Well, our context today, of course, is, you know, cloud transformation. Everybody's hearing it. I think that cloud now is finally starting to mature. People are pulling back and investing in. You know, a lot of people, what they don't realize is that today the cloud is nothing that the cloud wasn't 20 years ago. I was doing everything that Google does now, or Microsoft or Amazon 20 years ago for infrastructure people. It all starts at a virtual machine and an operating system. It's just the tooling is a little bit more advanced. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I think the cloud of today is hugely a huge step forward compared to the early clouds, and really represents a transformative period, I believe, for all companies and really the world at large.
All right. So let's talk about you a little bit. Who are you? What is your background? Where are you based? Where did all this come about?
Absolutely, yeah. So I'm based in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I've spent at this point almost 25 years in data management and databases. So kind of all started back in University of Wisconsin-Madison about 25 years back. I was doing my master's, and the university was really the hotbed, if you will, of database research. And that got me hooked into data management. And since then, spent a number of years at multiple large and small database companies, starting with Oracle, where I spent many years working on the Oracle database from version 8i through 12 and beyond. And then sort of jumped into the sort of the thick of things at Facebook, where I led the big data platform teams. These are the teams that are running this huge data infrastructure that underpins all of Facebook properties. So I did that for a number of years. And now I'm at Google Cloud, working on, again, databases, but with the cloud twist.
So Facebook, that's probably where we derived. And before we geek out, I'm going to ask you another question, but it's topical here. Presto, right? Was originally a Meta project?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Presto is this huge highlight for me in my career, where it literally began as many of these projects with no idea of like what it's going to turn out. Four of us sitting around the table circa 2012. Just thinking of like, hey, we have got this problem of like really slow queries over these large data sets, and how can we make these queries lightning fast? And from that, Presto was born, and it's this huge, both open source and a huge impact that you see today.
Okay, so again, we're about to geek out here, but I gotta ask. You know, one of the things about this podcast is, although we're technical professionals, we try to remember that we're also people, right? Mm-hmm. So what is something that you're passionate about that has nothing to do with data and work?
Wow. I mean, work is obviously one part of life, but one of the things that I've recently, over the last few years, really gotten hooked on is just this overall focus on mindfulness and meditation. And it's one of those things that I can look back and really see that, hey, it's transformed my life. Now I'm really kind of go as deep as I can in terms of just figuring out more ways to get that benefits of meditation and finding that inner balance. And it's truly, yeah, transformed my life, and try to spend as much time as I can on that aspect as well.
All right. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to explore that a little bit, just because that was not the answer I expected. Usually it's I got into cooking, or I enjoy, well, like for myself, I'm a nomad and I enjoy converting school buses into RVs. What you just said is frankly far more introspective and could clearly change people, or not change people, but change their, say, their outlook or their feelings of self, and being able to understand where they're going. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Oh yeah. I mean, again, a lot of this is your mileage may vary, kind of a warning that comes with it. But I think at the core of it, just having that mindfulness and just realizing kind of the full potential of our life and kind of all the trappings of it, kind of the material side, but also the spiritual aspects of things. I think there is just a lot of good that it can do, both at an individual level, as well as how we interact with other people and with the community and so on. So there is one particular program that I would like to highlight here called Inner Engineering. So this is a non-religious, very something that will appeal to sort of the rational part of our minds. There is this program, folks should look it up, called Inner Engineering, and that has been a really transformative experience for me.
So was there something that led you down the path of, you know, obviously, like you said, without getting into like religion, because that's a totally different discussion. But was there something, you know, a trigger in your life that said, hey, I need to take a step back. I need to figure out who I am so I can proceed forward in a positive way?
I think as with most folks kind of going through for many years, you're like super focused on like career, family, and so on. But inevitably, I think you reach a point where you just sort of want to take that step back and really get a deeper understanding of like what all of this is about. So in my case, nothing, no particular specific event or anything, but just over a period of time, that sense that, hey, like, what's the deeper meaning here? And I think especially in today's world, like everyone runs into points in time when you really want to sort of step back and reflect. So yeah, and when that happens, I was fortunate to get introduced to a few of these programs and really, yeah, kind of get deeper into it.
So I've always understood meditation as, I mean, for lack of a better way to put it, a form of prayer. Now, you may not be praying to a deity, but it is, you know, an introspection, a releasing of your mindset, really, so that you can explore whether it be your feelings or your thoughts. Is that correct?
This is a very deep topic, obviously. And again, growing up in India, just culturally kind of immersed in a lot of this notion of yoga and the sort of like many ways to approach like spirituality, whether in terms of just like work as a form of prayer, or like real prayer, or just like thinking deeply about certain subjects and so on. So for me, the meditation is really about both sort of that body and mind harmony, if you will, in terms of breathing and just like introspection and creating that level of attention to kind of what is going on within your body and what's going on within your mind.
I'm not trying to create like a, you know, meditation 401 here, just, you know, nice little overview for people to understand.
Absolutely. It's definitely a topic. it's a deep topic, and would encourage folks to go figure out what works for themselves.
Fair enough. All right. Well, we're going to move forward here, but you did mention you grew up in India. So you are an immigrant. which is awesome.
That's
When did you
right.
move to the States?
I moved back in 1994 after my bachelor's. So I joined the master's program in University of Wisconsin-Madison. And yeah, so that was my first plane ride, if you will, and landed here. And after master's, got to California and yeah, stayed here ever since.
You know, it's funny. We've had a, obviously it's not that hard to find someone from India in tech. But we had the CEO of Timescale, and we had a, I believe, is a VP of yours or Google's as well. And they both said the same thing of how they got into tech. It was, if I recall correctly, my parents said you're either going to be an engineer or a doctor. No artists, no cooks, no plumbers. You're an engineer or you're a doctor. Would you describe that as your upbringing as well?
Well, it's very similar. Both my parents were very supportive of like me sort of doing well in life and so on. And these are sort of the well-trodden paths. But the thing for me that I really like craved and got a lot of satisfaction was just like building things and solving some interesting problems and actually having the solution be used by a lot of people. So that's been sort of guiding a lot of my work over the years is, hey, where can I go to like solve interesting problems, build new products, get people to like use it and get value from it. So that's been one of those guiding principles for me.
Okay, fair enough. All right, let's get into the geeky. All right, so cloud and transformation. Why? So this has been covered ad nauseum in every trade mag that you can think of, but I think it's important since you are on the ground doing this from an engineering perspective, leading large teams for this. Why is the transition to the cloud a big deal?
Yeah, cloud is one of these things that everyone talks about a lot, but if you really look at it from a historical standpoint, for about 20, 30 years, like IT just grew and expanded and sort of matured in an on-premise data center, in a proprietary software stacks running there. And it worked fine for a while, but what it ended up with was this sort of fairly rigid, fairly slow-moving, very expensive setup. So that's sort of the historical backdrop. And then cloud came along and really provided this promise of, hey, you can move fast, you can do rapid innovation, and you can do it in a much more cost-effective way. So that sort of really goes to the heart of the value proposition of cloud is it just unleashes this level of flexibility and a level of speed that directly feeds into your innovation cycle for any problem that you're trying to solve. And at the heart of it is like cost effective. So that dramatically changes the landscape. And over the last many years, you've kind of seen this momentum build up where literally every enterprise, every company, every government out there is looking at how do we get back into that agile, fast-paced innovation cycles and keep our costs under control. And the public cloud really offers a great value for those problems. So it's one of those truly transformative things that I believe we'll look back another like 10, 15 years from now and like the landscape will have completely sort of transformed in terms of how hardware and software kind of works in the world.
So it's interesting. First, I agree with you, but I think that there's something that we forget. The cloud can, in fact, reduce your costs quite a bit. You know, our company, Command Prompt, we're only 20 people. We use Google Cloud. We don't use managed Postgres, I think, which would be for obvious reasons. But you know, we use the Google Suite. You know, we use GCE a lot, that type of thing. But you know, the type of company we are, where we are helping very large companies and even small companies deploy Postgres and open source in the best manner possible. One of the things that we've run into, and just hear me out, is that cloud is not cheaper. And this is why. Cloud is cheaper on paper, but you can't fix stupid. And the reality is a lot of people, what they do is they deploy on cloud thinking that they're going to reduce their costs. But the problem is it's not the cost of the cloud that are the issue, or even the cost of the data center the issue. It's a behavioral problem.
Yep.
They refuse to plan appropriately. They refuse to unit test appropriately. They listen to salespeople, not technical people. So they'll get an SOW for $30,000, and then they say, deploy. And the engineering team comes back and says, this is not a $30,000 project. This is a $130,000 project. And they're like, don't care, deploy. And then it's at $50,000 in, and they're like, why is this taking so long? And you come back and you're like, well, we told you before we hit a single key, right, for deploying, that this is going to be too much.
Yeah. And now we hear this problem constantly from our customers. So what you're describing absolutely is a problem of today. But at the heart of it, I think, is really also a set of things that clouds have to do better at, which is providing the tools and the visibility and the governance that you can put around your how you use the cloud and the kind of the costs associated with it. So there are a few things coming down the pipe without going into too many details. I think the problem is real, but this is one of those problems. As more and more of the teams and more people are using the cloud, there is a need for creating those guardrails. And there is, in fact, an opportunity to create more effective tooling that both ensures those best practices in terms of governance and resource utilization and so on, but also gives visibility and controls at an organization level to ensure that, as you said, like, people are not doing dumb things, but like they're sort of very much doing the right things for the project and for the company. So not a perfect solution today, but I think our customers are inevitably sort of pushing us as cloud providers to provide all of those things.
So you hit on something there. It would seem to me that perhaps at least the major cloud providers, you know, you're talking Google, Microsoft, Amazon, IBM, you know, that there's a responsibility, because one of the things, you know, I've been in this industry, I'm going to be 50 years old. I've been in this industry since I was 17. And I see, you know, generation after generation, everything from back when Novell 312 was the thing to run, to running around with a vacuum doing computer maintenance with Xenix machines, to, you know, all the way up to the point where, you know, I was one of the first people selling Linux machines, 486 DX266 with 16 meg of RAM and a 1 gig SD hard drive, you know, for to be Linux workstations, right? Back with SLS or Yggdrasil.
Right.
And I'm coming all the way forward and I've watched all this transformation. And the one, and I think this is changing, but I'd like some confidence from you. Throughout that 33 years, I've learned a couple things. One, pain hurts only after 35. That's the first thing. But the real thing here is that for a long time, and I think predominantly this is still the case, companies don't listen very well either to their internal teams or to outside consultants. Mm-hmm. And the larger companies selling don't care because it just means more money for them. Now, I think that that's changing, but the issue at hand is, doesn't Google or Microsoft or Amazon have a responsibility to say, look, if you want to save money, if you want to be more efficient, if you want to be more agile, deploy faster, have better availability for your products and services, there are best practices. Shouldn't Google be sitting in the room with the C-level execs and saying, stop, you know your business, you don't know ours, so you need to listen to us about how you deploy on these platforms?
Absolutely. So this has to be a close partnership, and you're already seeing signs of that with some of the things that we're doing on Google Cloud around financial governance, doing recommendations about things like over-provisioned instances or idle instances, and doing sort of automatic detection and sort of shutting down unused resources and so on. So I think this will just continue into the future, where it's not just about like making it easy to use things, but really making it easy to do the right things. And it starts all the way from the top in terms of how companies should be planning their expenses, all the way down to a team level and an individual level, where that sort of visibility and governance kicks in. And this is a two-way street. Customers, ultimately, for a cloud provider, what we want to do is deliver value that is what like customers are paying for. And that works best when they are innovating and they are creating new products and doing well in their business. So yeah, I mean, this is changing. I think we are now in that phase of like, oh shit, like it's like these bills are crazy, like what's going on? And now it's like, hey, what are the controls? What are the tools? And now how does and Google works very closely with like many, many large companies on how to set up their infrastructure in a way that lends itself to all of these best practices. So, and cloud is very much in a high change environment right now. Year over year, you're seeing a lot of new things coming. And I don't anticipate that sort of finishing anytime soon. I think we're still like sort of midway, I would say, in the cloud transformation journey.
Well, from a practical standpoint, you know, one of the things that there are two things that I truly love about Google Cloud. One, I'll look at my, you know, I'll review the bill with our leadership. I'm like, what the hell? And they like, well, what'd you do? Because I'm the guy that always goes off and fires off an instance to test something, then I forget about it, right? And I'll log in to the console, and you guys tell me right away, you are spending $45 a month on this instance. It only needs to be $12 a month. Why? You know, you tell me you could save, and you also tell me this instance is overloaded. You might want to consider updating it. It is awesome. The other thing that I really enjoy is that when I provision a machine with all of its various little tidbits, you give me the API call.
That's right.
I actually sat in a conference, I think it was 2017. It was our big national conference that we run in New York, not us, the Postgres conference project. And I was sitting with Mark Porter, who's now the CTO of MongoDB, but at the time was running AWS RDS and all that stuff. And he asked me, well, hey, JD, why don't you just run on AWS? And I'm like, nothing against AWS, but the reality is Google's does it the way that I think about it, because at my heart, I'm a technical person, and these are the things they provide. And one of the greatest things about that is I remember a time when if I would have sat down in that conversation, it would have been defensive. And Mark was so humble, and he's like, you know, I've never even logged into that console. I haven't seen it. I want to thank you for this feedback. I don't know if they changed it. I'd have to ask one of my teams. But it was really great to have an interaction where, sure, you're competitors, but you're really just trying, you're each trying to be the best that you can be. And, you know, like I tell a lot of people in the Postgres community, there's no reason for us not to like each other. There is more money out there than we know what to do with when it comes to Postgres. Postgres is just at the beginning, even though we've been around since 97. It is just at the beginning of what's coming for Postgres, and we're in 2023.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And in fact, Postgres is one of our key sort of both investment areas and a key part of like the Google Cloud database strategy. But going back to your other point, I think all clouds are really still in that learning stage where we are learning from each other, learning like what's working well for our customers and what's not. And it's constantly improving. the amount of change that you can see, say, on GCP, like year over year, is just truly staggering in terms of new services, new capabilities, just new abilities that, and they're all driven by these customer requirements and feedback. And that rapid pace of change is really very exciting to see. And there's a lot of exchange that's happening. Like we look at, yeah, what other clubs are doing, and I'm sure they look at what we are doing, and constantly, yeah, trying to keep improving our services.
All right, so you know, Google's massive. I mean, I think everybody knows that. I mean, well, and you know, obviously Alphabet on top. How do you increase visibility into cutting edge problems? Right. How do you, the larger you get, I think that people for, you know, when people complain about Google or they complain about Facebook or they complain about Amazon or whatever, you know, everybody needs someone to pick on for some reason. I don't know why. I don't know what's wrong with their id that makes that the case. But when you take an organization as large as yours, it's not really unlike, you know, the government, right? The government, unless it's a military thing, really doesn't move very fast. And I think that Google, although you do move quickly, it's hard to take a, you know, you can't just slam on the brakes and take a hard left. You're talking about, say, a series of teams of 15,000 people for whatever project, right? How do you stay nimble?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, a question top of mind for many executives at many large companies is how do you continue to innovate and move fast? Because if companies don't move fast, are not able to adapt quickly, they just die. And we have seen many examples of that. So I think one of the things with Google is really the heart of it is that culture of engineering where teams are empowered to stay curious, innovate, and sort of the recognition reward system is set up to really like help encourage that nimbleness. Now there are, it doesn't like all work out perfectly. I've got to admit, like as with all large companies, there are like processes and there are things that small companies don't have to necessarily worry about. But at a large enough scale, just to give one example, right? You've got this Google Cloud platform, and you want to introduce a new service into this platform. If you are outside, like you just do your thing and you launch it and see how it goes. But the moment you're launching it in this Google Cloud platform, there is a level of expectation of consistency, like in terms of how does security work and how does availability work and how do the dashboards look, and you can imagine like 100 of these, which from a customer standpoint makes a lot of sense because I come into the platform, I'm using 10 services out of the 100 that are there, but I want these 10 services to work together well, and that is a promise that we are making our customers, but that immediately raises the bar in terms of anything new that you have to do will take longer, and it's a much larger project and a much larger effort. So the way we think about it is really, yes, it may feel like some things are going slower, but you move slow in order to sort of move fast as a whole, because that consistency and that uniform experience across all of our services is hugely valuable for our customers. Like when you come to GCP, hopefully you see it as an integrated platform and not as like 25 different things that look very different from each other and don't work with each other. So the way I look at it and the way I sort of work with my teams is how do you balance that agility? There are certain things that you can move fast, get a lot of quick feedback, but there are some other decisions that are like one-way doors that you want to spend a lot more time, a lot more discipline and rigor and do it right the first time. So very subtle balance to be had, but on the whole, when you kind of look at Google of today, given the size it is at, I think it's doing very well in terms of sort of moving fast and adapting and continue to sort of drive that innovation But it's hard, and it's a constant challenge, and that's where a lot of the leadership every day sort of tries to do the best in terms of balancing this.
You know, it's interesting. You said you've used the term perfection. One of the things about Google, and I'll be honest, it's irritated me, is Google tends to incrementally introduce various things through a cycle. And like first it was, you know, here's Gmail, and now Gmail, and then here's chat. And we don't need to go down the 740 different chats you've had, you know, chat technologies, but, and then there's tasks, and then there's contacts. And then all of a sudden, over time, things are molding together. And now Gmail is my chat. It's my email. It interfaces with my calendar. Something, the tasks, although I don't think as far as it needs to be, has started to become something very useful for me, because I can click on an email, make it a task, give it a time. All of a sudden, it's on my calendar, that kind of integration. And the reason I bring that together up is that a lot of people out there strive for perfection. And I'm going to steal a quote from our CEO, Amanda Nystrom. Perfection is the enemy of good enough. Because you can't get good, you can't get perfection. It's a false idol. When you strive for perfection, you are just worshiping a false idol. But if you go for good enough and you learn from the mistakes along the way, as well as the mistakes that happen after, it continues to get better. Yep. That, and you can't please everyone all the time.
Especially when you're building a product for like millions or billions of users, there's absolutely no way you can make everyone super happy. So I think that sort of core philosophy of like iterate, right? Like your job is never done. You're always just constantly getting feedback, improving, putting out new capabilities, and really look at that as the journey, right? Like it's not you launch it and you're done. It's really you launch it, you learn, you iterate, and keep launching, right? So you keep doing that. Now there is a balance there in terms of we don't want to confuse users, and like some products have kind of gone through those challenges in terms of things changing too much, too quickly, and confusing users and so on. But to your point, like perfection, there's another interesting saying that I like, which is the perfect product is the one that hasn't launched and will never launch.
Right.
So there you go. So we definitely adhere to that philosophy of like, let's get it to a good enough stage and let's get it out there and get some real mileage on it. But there are, especially in a technology stack, there are certain layers where you can afford to take more risks, things that are more stateless and don't have like very bad consequences of getting it wrong. Whereas as you go lower in the stack, dealing with things like data durability, integrity, availability, the bar is much higher that like we really, really don't want to get it wrong. So it really depends on the problem at hand, but using that judgment and just like innovating quickly and iteratively makes all the difference.
Agreed. All right. So we've actually talked about it. We actually covered a couple of the topics already. Basically continuous integration, right? You test, you improve, you test, you improve, you test, you improve. I'd like to throw that out to our listeners that that should be your life as well, right? When you get into a rut, you know, in life, the goal as a whole, right? We all have little micro goals, whether it's to own a second home or even just to be able to eat for the day, whatever the case may be. But the one goal that a lot of people forget, they get wrapped up in whatever it is that's going on in their life, is just to be a better person. And part of being a better person, one, is forgiveness. And it's forgiveness of others as well as forgiveness of yourself. But learning, right? You just continue to, you move forward, you make a mistake, step back, observe the mistake, learn from the mistake, go around it, keep going. When we get wrapped up in politics or religion, or not that there's much difference between those two things, when we get wrapped up in that, We're forgetting what really matters. What really matters is you and me having this conversation, trying to figure out how to be better as people and as, you know, companies. What is the unsolved problem of the day? If you were to sit back and, you know, you meditate. So what is the unsolved problem that just sits there in, on the back of your neck, you know, in that spot that you just can't get rid of the headache?
Oh boy. I think the sort of all of us, I think, grapple with this notion of what is that one problem that if you can solve, you really feel like you've made progress. And for me, I kind of look at this as the sort of different layers and on different timescales. In work, I mean, there is definitely a set of problems that need to be solved over the next week, over the next month, year, what have you. And then there are certain things that are more about just like, if you will, something that's probably said a lot is like, hey, what's the meaning of life, right? And like, what are we here for? And what does all of this mean? And for me, I think when we kind of look at specifically from a work and a career standpoint, I think this cloud transformation is that transformative experience that is going to reshape a lot of how like infrastructure and how software works in the new world, and being part of that journey and constantly pushing on like, hey, how can we make things faster, cheaper, easier to use, and have this be used by the largest number of people out there. I think that's, to me, definitely an open problem in terms of how do you make, I mean, systems are complex, but companies also need to go solve their business problems. So how do we make it really easy for them to use our products and get the most value out of it and have it be fast and cheap and performant? Those are, I think, they're unsolved problems. We keep making progress, but they're never like fully done. So it's a little bit of a bringing it back to the work side of things, but I truly think there are some really, really big problems out there in terms of how you, from a data management standpoint, there's the faster, cheaper, better, but also how do we make it available to the most number of people out there, democratize data access, while also preserving things like security and privacy, and set up the systems in a way that doesn't compromise one for the other.
All right. You know, this is actually, this next topic is a little bit tough. You know, given Google's size and your reach, I mean, you are truly global. And how do you, I mean, does Google have a greater responsibility in terms of ensuring, I mean, again, nothing's perfect, but ensuring responsible and ethical use?
I think Google is a very critical part of this global community. And so with that sort of great power does come a lot of importance on like how to do it in a responsible way, but also being transparent about things that are working well and where there are challenges that we need to work with the broader community to solve some of these problems. Because at the heart of it, many of these big problems are not just Google, but problems that Google can just like solve by itself. I think it goes to the heart of like very fundamental questions about, hey, as a society, how do we set up these sort of rules that all of us play by? And some of these have to be debated and figured out as a society as a whole. So to that end, I mean, I think Google has this huge impact on the world through these amazing services that are used by billions of people. Both within the company, there's a lot of focus and importance on respecting that user and respecting the opportunity, and really asking ourselves like some really hard questions all the time in terms of like, hey, what is the right thing to do? But also engage in that conversation and discussion with the broader community. This happens in many, many forums that you would see, and keep that dialogue going, because these problems, as I said, can't be solved just by one company or one team. These really need a very broad participation. And that's where I think Google really has that history also of just engaging with the broader community in that dialogue and keep chipping away at these problems.
Can you describe an example of one of the problems that you feel, that frankly, what we're talking about is a problem that's larger than Google, right? So, but it's something that Google needs to address as well as other big players in the ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we look at projects like say Android as one of these examples of these large projects that have so many partners that Google works with, in terms of like, hey, how do you evolve this operating system? What sort of capabilities do we want to put into it in terms of like security features and so on? Those are, I think, really great examples of where the community at large is really shaping the evolution of this sort of global operating system, if you will. And every new release of Android, I mean, you see new features and capabilities coming, and a lot of it is shaped by that feedback and dialogue.
I'm glad you brought up Android. First, I'm going to talk to my personal need that I'm hoping that you'll solve. And then we can talk about some of the elephants in the room about Android. We are doing this podcast and I'm recording on an Android tablet, specifically a Samsung tablet. And I have an S21 Ultra Samsung phone and I love it. I run Ubuntu on my laptop. Now, I have nothing against Ubuntu. I've been running Linux longer than most people by far. You know, my first Linux distribution was SLS. I remember running Tiny Linux off of a 1.44 megabyte floppy, right? The whole bit. Yes. And I do love Ubuntu. But I'll tell you what I would love more. I would love Android on my laptop. And it's a selfish reason. But here's why. If I had Android on my laptop, I would have appropriate licensed codecs so that I can watch my videos. But more importantly, I am a digital tabletop player. So I have like 50 board games, but they're on Android. And I don't like having to have four different devices. If I had Android on my laptop, I wouldn't need this tablet. And frankly, I wouldn't need my phone, except that, you know, the laptop's a little bit big to carry. When do I not have to load up some hacky VM to run Android on my laptop? Or at least Android apps, right? Or at least Google needs to release like a Android container that I install on Ubuntu. That's fine. And it fires up. And I know there's projects out there, people. Don't email me. I know they're out there. That I can just, you know, install Google Play and give them all my personal information so you can sell me advertising that I won't click on, but I can play my games.
I hear you. And let me promise that I'll take this request back to our Android teams and see what we can do. But I'm glad to hear that you love the Android family, and it truly reflects contributions of like great many people over many, many years to create such a broadly successful product. And it's really also the community at large has contributed so much to this that, but I will take your, I will pass along your request.
Thank you. Means a lot. No, so, you know, Android, Google has an interesting relationship with open source, and I'd like to talk about the Postgres community here in a second. But, you know, what I think a lot of people don't realize is that Google helps organize the development of, I mean, steers the development of and deploys the development of the two largest Linux distributions in the world. And that one is Android, which, you know, a lot of people think, I don't run Linux, I run Android. You're running a Linux distribution when you run Android. Last year I was in a Best Buy, and there was an older gentleman who was trading in his flip phone. Yes, 2022.
It's still out there.
The sales associate, bless his heart, was like, you know, get an Apple. And I have nothing against Apple, except that they're a walled garden. Other than that, I don't really have a problem with them. Get an Apple. It'd be easier for you to use, blah, blah, blah. And I walked by and I said, look, no disrespect to Apple, but like 95% of the world runs Android.
That's right.
And he's like, you're kidding. And I'm like, yeah, granted, in the United States, for phones, I think I just read this, Apple has the majority. But if you're talking about worldwide deployment and interoperability, we're talking about Android. And it's on Linux, and Google steers the development of that. Is there any, response? I mean, of course you feel this. I'm not trying to be provocative. But what is the greatest responsibility that Google feels toward that?
Yeah, I mean, as you correctly pointed out, I mean, if you look at the world at large, like Android is this pervasive, almost ubiquitous operating system. And it's just one of those hugely successful projects that has had so much impact on the world. And as I mentioned earlier, it really is shaped by the broader community. There's a lot of feedback that goes into kind of what every new version of Android, like what are the capabilities, what are the changes, and constantly working with a huge set of partners, hardware and so on, to really make this seamless, magical experience work. And doing this in a walled garden is hard, but doing this in a open bazaar is like much, much harder, as you can imagine, in terms of the number of people out there that all kind of play in this playground. But that's really one of the huge strengths that Google brings to this, is that ability to work with this large set of stakeholders and continue to drive the community forward in a way that's like sort of maximally impactful. It's hard, super challenging, but that's where I think you see Google really shine in terms of being those stewards of this movement. And for us, it's like super exciting to be able to have that level of sort of impact on the world.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, anyone who's been involved as open source recognizes that there's a difference between a product and a project. You know, products, whether open source or not, you can control the direction. Collaboration is there, but it's largely through a single lens. Like, even if you have a bunch of partners, all the partners are coming together and we're like, we're trying to deliver X. Whereas a project, like you said, it's a bazaar. You have no idea what someone's going to drop in your lap and say, look what I just created. And sometimes it's, well, this is really interesting. Sometimes it's like, have you lost your mind? And sometimes it's really scary. And I would agree. I think that, you know, giving Google its props, I mean, you have delivered a lot of critical mass technology that people take for granted. Android's one of them. Email. Now, you didn't really solve the email problem. That problem had been solved a long time ago with various different ways. But what you did do is, in a large part, solve the spam problem and the searchability problem, which is huge. And then, of course, Chrome OS, you might disagree, but I think is still kind of trying to find its footing. It's certainly making strides, but it's not. You know, I bought my daughter a Chrome OS, you know, a Chromebook, and being the type of person that I am, it just frustrated me more than anything else. But it was good for her, right? Because I had a whole lot less support requests, let's put it that way, as a dad. And the big one, I think, and this one gets talked about a lot, isn't deployed or used nearly as much as people think it is or say it is. And frankly, from my perspective, it solved a problem that didn't exist, but that's because I'm dealing with a very narrow set of problems, and that's Kubernetes, of course. But that being said, clearly, it is moving forward, it is maturing, and you guys, gave this to the world. I'm not sure I'm happy with that on that one, but let's talk about Postgres, because you've always had, I mean, Google and PostgreSQL.org and PostgresConf and the professional community, we've talked many times in the past. There was at one point I had a conversation, this was 2016 or 2017, and we were talking about having Google give contributions back to PostgreSQL.org. And one of your ideas was, if I remember correctly, was a page inspect module that would allow to check for the whether or not page files had been corrupted. And now you've gone farther. I mean, you have your competitor to RDS, which, GCP. And then you have your competitor to Aurora, which would be Alloy DB. But there's a lot of other players out there. I mean, obviously, Microsoft has its Azure stuff and its Cosmos DB. But you don't. How are you let? What is your intent now? Are you looking to not intend to integrate, but directly contribute back to PostgreSQL.org? Are you looking to, or are you at a minimum looking to broaden the ecosystem with independent projects per se?
When we think about Postgres, just to take a step back, so I joined Google about now almost 4 years back. And over the last few years, we've just done a huge amount of both. We're sort of basically betting on Postgres, is a short way of saying it, is in terms of as the open interface to databases, we are basically betting that, hey, Postgres is that interface that companies will want to standardize around. And this is driving sort of multiple parts of kind of what you're seeing on the Google Cloud Platform, and specifically sort of three aspects that I want to touch on here. So one is our Cloud SQL product is basically managed Postgres. So this is where you get like literally any version of Postgres out there from the past 10 years, including some that have been deprecated by the community, but we're still supporting it, and so on through, and that continues to be super critical for us to provide that fully managed, very easy to spin up and easy to use experience for Postgres. The second part of it is we've got this database called Spanner, which is this amazing global, highly available database. And we put a Postgres interface on top of it. So it's not Postgres compatible, but it is a Postgres-like interface to try and remove some of that friction of people trying to use Spanner for their use cases that really fit into that. And then the third part is with Alloy DB, and this was a project that I started when I joined Google, really based on this bet that Postgres as an interface is really amazing, but how do we, on the Google Cloud environment, how do we bring more power of that Google infrastructure to bear so that folks get an even better Postgres experience with Alloy DB? So that's sort of the genesis of Alloy DB that you've seen, where it's this 100% compatible Postgres database sitting on top of and leveraging the underlying Google infrastructure in terms of a scale-out storage, high performance, high availability, things for both transactional as well as analytic type use cases. But the sort of the common thread across these three products is this Postgres interface. So that kind of goes to show kind of the commitment that Google is making around this. As part of that, what you will see in the coming years is just a more deepening investment even in the community, both by ways of some of the tools that you mentioned right? So things that sort of sit outside of core Postgres, but really add to the capabilities in terms of like making it easy to debug or monitor or what have you, as well as over time, definitely engaging more on the core aspects of it as well. Part of this is a journey where at Google, we want to sort of first learn from our customers really where some of those bigger pain points are and where we, along with the community, can kind of make the biggest impact in terms of creating new value. So that's kind of the journey that we've been on. We continue to be super excited to be part of the community and find ways by which we can engage both in terms of those tools as well as the core engine. So you will see a lot more of this coming in the near future.
No, well, you say the interface, and the way I refer to it, and I have for years, is it's the kernel, right? So the operating system kernel is Linux. That is, it doesn't matter what Apple does. It doesn't and even Microsoft is kind of thrown in the flag at this point on Linux. But like, okay, so we can either embrace it or die. I mean, that's pretty much their only option. So they embraced it, which was good on them. So Linux is your operating system kernel, and it runs the world. It really does. It even runs your in-flight entertainment. It runs your ability to buy things at Lowe's. It runs my laptop. It runs this tablet and this podcast. But then you have your data kernel, and your data kernel is Postgres. Now, that doesn't mean there won't be other kernels out there, just like there's a free, there's free BSD, which is a remarkable operating system. It is awesome. I have no problem with free BSD. It's not as pervasive as Linux. Your pervasive data kernel for the foreseeable future is going to be Postgres. Now, that may be through the API. An example of this would be, say, CockroachDB, where they're not Postgres compatible at all, but they use the same protocol, so they didn't have to create all their own drivers. Right? Or it may be through the core engine, where this is where, say, AlloyDB, the underlying storage mechanisms and stuff are different. Same with Aurora. But when you interface with it, it's just Postgres.
That's right. And that 100% compatibility, as you pointed out, I mean, there are gradations in terms of like what aspects of Postgres is available in these products. But with AlloyDB, what we have intended and accomplished is this thing of 100%. It is the Postgres engine that you're interacting with all the way from your client into the server side, and the rich ecosystem of like extensions and everything that you get with it. So it is Postgres, but you get an enhanced experience with it when you're running in this AlloyDB configuration. So we truly believe that is going to be this ubiquitous database engine for the future. And it's kind of interesting how the community, like Postgres, as you mentioned earlier, has been around for a long time, but the last few years, I think, have really seen this huge uptick in terms of both the realization that, hey, this is like a really, really good thing to sort of center around, and at Google we are really excited to be part of that that movement.
So I just wanted to clarify 100% compatibility, and I'm not saying you're being untruthful, it's more of a question. So Aurora is not 100% compatible, neither is RDS. And what I mean by that is, specifically with RDS, Postgres, there are some specific limitations to what extensions you can run. You're not actually a super user, that type of thing. How did AlloyDB deal with that? Like, can I just go off and say I want to run PG whatever extension and just install it in AlloyDB? Or is there a canonical list of approved extensions, or what kind of privilege escalation am I dealing with, that type of stuff?
Yeah, now this comes to the heart of like, what does it mean to be a managed service, right? So it's really a part of this is what comes with a managed service as opposed to self-managed, right? So if you self-manage, obviously you've got like that full control over all the flags and various configurations and so on, and you can install kind of whatever you want into it and so on. But with the managed service comes some guardrails, and we are constantly sort of tweaking and refining that to get that best balance between, as a user, we really want you to be able to do whatever you would like to do in terms of building your applications and having that capability, while still having enough guardrails that makes it very, very hard and ideally prevents you from like doing or getting into trouble. And
eliminating foot guns.
Getting the value of the managed service, right? So this is, yes, with a managed service, you are giving up some control, but hopefully the value that you get in return in terms of not having to worry about a whole bunch of things more than makes up for the bit that you give up.
Okay, so there, to spit that back out, Ajay, to give you what I heard, there are limitations. You're not necessarily a super user. There is you can't install any extension.
Right.
There's an approved list. I assume the same goes for, say, languages that you can develop procedures with, things like that.
That's right. That's right. And
okay.
It's a constantly growing and evolving list. Part of how that is going. Yeah.
Yeah, certainly. For the pedantic members of the or listeners, you know, that wouldn't be 100% compatible. It is, I mean, and I get where you're coming from. Don't get me wrong. I just wanted to be clear. You mentioned about, you know, you're going to hear in the future more contributions coming from Google. And without getting into, you know, recent events, but, you know, in news, how would you describe that as happening? I think that there's some concern or maybe cautionary tales there about if Google wants to participate directly with the community to make a better project, how is Google planning on doing that? Because we do see it from Amazon, right? And we do see it from Microsoft. They both have contributors on staff that are consistently interacting with the hackers, trying to produce a better product, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think in this respect, Google is a few years behind kind of where we would want to end up with in terms of having, similar to our other clouds competitors, like having both contributors and committers on staff, but also identifying areas where Google can bring something unique to the table, right? So that's part of what we are trying to sort of figure out is, hey, are there some specific things around like potentially like infrastructure by way of these like large scale testing. Because one of the things just to mention with AlloyDB, what we have done is internally built up a very comprehensive testing framework that literally like it's a very large scale, including like random query generation and various fault injection type tests and so on. Very, very sophisticated, and a lot of it is sort of using some internal Google tooling that's sort of generally available for all projects. But one of the potential areas is like, hey, is that something we can like contribute back out in a way that just helps the community to just get that much broader expansion in terms of test scenarios and so on, and actually provide the infrastructure to be able to run it. So not making any promises at this point.
Sure.
Those are some examples where we are really looking at, what can Google do that is like really like unique value that like Google can provide, as opposed to just saying, okay, here are like some folks on our like staff that are working on sort of general projects. I mean, we'll still want to do some of that, but the interest here is in sort of figuring out like that, the unique value that Google can bring to the community.
Okay. Well, as we close out, first, let me say it's been a pleasure. Is there anything that you'd like to add or ad lib or pimp?
Absolutely. But thank you for this great conversation. I think we covered a lot of different topics. But just to leave your listeners with the last thoughts on databases, obviously a huge area of focus for us, and Postgres is at the at the core of it. Really looking forward to both increasing our engagement with the community, as I mentioned, finding ways to both help and contribute. And the future is really, really bright. And we at Google are super excited, as I mentioned, to be part of this journey and look forward to that kind of the amazing future where Postgres takes over the world.
I would argue that it already has. And with that, this has been More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it.